papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk.
So we'll talk about all sorts of things today, folks. We're going to have an interesting conversation on the Media Project. Let's explain who we are around here. Young lady.
You must be talking to me. I'm Judy Patrick. I was editor for a long time for a daily newspaper. Now I work for the New York Press Association trying to save us all from oblivion.
Save us all. Yes, and you, young lady.
This is Barbara Lombardo, and not to correct you, Rex, but as somebody who is clearly not as young a lady as I used to be, I don't like that term.
Right.
I think it's unintentionally demeaning.
Outmoded. Actually, I remember watching Joe Biden on the campaign stump how many years ago that was when he was running. And he kept using the phrase, ladies and gentlemen, and that's a really old phrase, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? We just don't say that kind of thing anymore.
Hello. Well, he also used to say folks.
Folks, yeah.
Try to wrap every
young lady is Jerry Lewis. Young lady!
And that identifies the oldest guy in the room. Sorry there, Ira. So
do you remember Jerry Lewis? Nobody has ever heard
of
him.
Of course.
Yeah, so I would be Ira Fussfeld, and it all started at a 5,000-watt radio station. Oh, no, that's Ted Baxter. I am the retired publisher of the Daily Freeman of Kingston, New York.
Absolutely.
Did I give my name? I'm Barbara Lombardo, the former executive editor of the Saratogian and the Troy Record, and currently an adjunct in journalism at UAlbany.
All right. Very good. We are here. Oh, and I'm Rex Smith. I am a publisher, editor, creator, etc. Actually, trash can emptier at the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union for those many years. Because here we are, folks who have had a lot of experience in mainstream media. And one of the things that we want to talk about today is opinion writing in those publications, because that is where there's been a lot of controversy. And just to help folks understand, of course, there are separate parts to a publication, to an outfit like WAMC, where you have news coverage and you also have opinion. There's commentary on the radio. And in the newspapers, of course, the text-based journalistic outlets, there's news coverage and there are opinion pages, editorial pages, op-ed pages. And this is where there is often a lot of controversy, lately especially. Most recently, there has been a lot of fighting about this at the Washington Post, where the owner of the paper, Jeff Bezos, has said that he wants the newspaper to reflect points of views. Everything in the opinion section now, he says, must focus on personal liberties and free markets. That rule prompted the editorial page editor, David Shipley, to quit. And within the past days, it did prompt a 41-year veteran of the newspaper, a great columnist named Ruth Marcus, to leave when a column she wrote was spiked, as we say, was killed by the publisher. Now, let's just talk for a minute about why a media publication ought to even have an opinion section. Ira, you're the veteran guy here. You worked up from being a sports writer to being sports editor to being editor and then publisher. Why did you think that it was important for your newspaper to have opinion coverage?
Well, I think that a newspaper is many things to many different people. And there are people who are only interested in the crossword puzzle. And then there are people who are interested only in the obits. And then there are people who are interested in opinion. And I always felt that most newspapers believe that the opinion section should be a broad cross-section of opinions. There shouldn't just be saying those ideas espoused by one political party and not the other is right. You should have two points of view or more on your pages. So historically, that's what has been the case at newspapers. What has happened in recent years for any number of reasons, that particularly in smaller newspapers, is that there is less opinion because there's less resources to produce that opinion. And also because we were getting a lot of feedback, we meaning editors and publishers, from people who believe that the news coverage was tainted by the opinion coverage. And that if the opinion was one way, then the news stories were also the same way. And although we could stand on our heads and say, though, no, that's not the case, people were believing it, and it was hurting our credibility and hurting, unfortunately, our sales.
So why would we bother?
I would say that the reason is that newspapers then and now have a larger calling than to merely report the news. It's important to report the news, but we also served, going back to the older lingo when I was a young lady, that it would be kind of a town square, that this would be the place where, serving the public, different voices could be heard, and that people knew that they could turn to their local newspaper, or their national newspaper, but their local newspaper mostly, for exchange of ideas and to let themselves be heard, to get their voices out there, and that serving the public would be the higher calling for the company, not serving the owners, although, as Ira alluded to, you also want to make enough money in the process to keep doing what you're doing.
So, but now, Judy, your paper, when you were the editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady, went back and forth on one key issue on the opinion pages, which is endorsement of candidates. Can you make an argument on either side of that?
I sure can. I was an editor. But an editorials basically are speaking on behalf of the masthead. And the opinion page in a print newspaper is easy to differentiate from the rest of the news coverage because it's on a different page. It's far more difficult when you're talking about a website where it's easy to be confused about what's what. We, for a long time at the Daily Gazette, did not endorse political candidates. We felt that was a decision up to the voters. We, for a short while, went back to, I think now they still do endorse candidates. It's a lot of work to endorse candidates, but it's a good exercise in terms of interviewing all the candidates and sitting down with them. I walk away believing that you do need to endorse candidates, because I think it's, to not do so is to kind of, to not do part of your job. I think part of our job was to offer our readers comprehensive viewpoints. And in addition, the opinions. The opinions are people, thoughtful, well-reasoned people from around the community telling us things that we weren't able to report on the hard news pages or the feature news pages in a compelling way. That opinion pieces give you a level of understanding of an issue that you can't get from a regular news story.
You know, it's interesting that what turns out to be good business for journalistic outlets is also good civic work. That is, giving voice to these people is really the right thing to do if you have the power of the press. If you're the news organization that is dominant in your community, it's the right thing to do to let other voices be heard other than the masthead, as you say, the editor, publisher, whoever it is who makes up the opinion section. And a great newspaper will recognize that. The Washington Post, being the example, is that they would have both on the right, George Will and Megan McArdle, on the left, they would have Eugene Robinson, Catherine Rempel. And the New York Times has had that, to the frustration of many people. Most of the staff opinion columnists at the New York Times are on the left, but they do have conservative voices as well, though not necessarily these days pro-Trump voices, because the terms liberal and conservative have sort of been blown away by some of the actions of Donald Trump. But if you are the owner of a newspaper, of course, you have a right to, in some way, control everything that paper does. And I think that what Bezos is doing at the Post is exercising his authority, but we would all agree that he's doing so unwisely and inappropriately for an entity that seeks to be a community institution like a newspaper.
But if he keeps his hands off of the rest of the paper, which is, as far as I can tell, he is doing, then it's appropriate for him to do what he's doing on the editorial page and either make a mistake or hit a home run with it. But, you know, there has been quite a movement of people deciding to cancel their subscription to the Washington Post in light of this recent development. And my opinion is that there are still hardworking journalists providing good news coverage from that paper, and they shouldn't be tampered with, and they shouldn't have the readers' backs turned on them. We have to see whether Bezos will carry his authority over to the rest of the paper.
I'm right with you on that one.
In the column that was spiked, by the way, maybe we should just do a little diversion here to talk about spike. Every desk in a newsroom used to have a spike on it.
There literally was a spike.
Yeah, a little thing about 3 inches tall, 4 inches tall, that you would put a paper copy of the story that you wrote.
Yeah, OSHA wouldn't allow it today.
Right. Actually, for a while, they created protected spikes so that you had a little arch over the top of it so you could stick a piece of paper in and spike it and without whacking the palm of your hand on it. And there's an old newsroom custom that it's bad luck to whistle in the newsroom. You know about that?
I've heard that.
Yeah. So I had an old rewrite guy when I was first a young reporter. I was walking across the newsroom whistling, and old Tom Demoretsky said to me, "If you keep whistling, I'm going to put a spike through your eye."
Ouch.
So I learned.
That stuck with you.
It certainly did. That was 40 years ago, and I have never whistled in a newsroom since.
So this decision to spike Ruth Marcus's column came from, apparently, right from the top, the very top.
Well, they've never said that, but there was a time lapse between when they would have normally told her your column's approved and when it was not approved. And I think the presumption, although she does not make this presumption, that Bezos literally had his hands on it, I suspect he was consulted. But the decision apparently was made by his underling.
By the publisher.
Yeah.
Right.
And this follows the spiking of an editorial in which they were going to endorse Kamala Harris for president.
Right.
And while they are espousing the need for editorials or columnists that only talk about personal liberty, I was imagining that Ruth Marcus was expressing her personal liberty at criticizing the decision to restrict the columnist, to kind of, as she described it, to put a shock collar around their columnist, and they never knew when it was going to go off because it was so amorphous. They didn't know what exactly personal liberty meant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a conundrum involved in this, and Ira and I worked for the same company for a number of years, and the owners of that company, you would know better than to write a story that was criticizing that company, even if the company was doing things in other parts of the country with papers that they owned and, you know, decimating newspapers. You would have to think twice before you went ahead to publish, certainly, commentary. I think they were even touchy about wanting to make sure if you were mentioning the company that it had to, you know, be bounced upstairs somewhere.
Well, they wanted to review it. If the company's name was going to be in a story, they wanted to see it first.
Yeah. So there were things where, was it in Detroit or Denver, where they were
the Denver Post mm-hmm. they own.
So there was some coverage of that, but it was done at your risk as the editor.
Absolutely. I thought that the column that was spiked, the Ruth Marcus column that led to her forced resignation, she talks about what columnists owe to readers. She said, "We ask them to trust that that is what we provide, that is their best judgment on any particular issue, that we aren't being told how to think or what to say or trimming our sails to stay out of dangerous waters. But once the changes are implemented, that is the changes that Bezos is requiring, I fear that readers will no longer be able to rely on such assurances because Bezos, as I read his message, has told them they can't. He won't publish views that don't conform to his principles." And so that is what is at stake here, because you're telling a columnist you can only write your opinion if your opinion agrees with the guy who owns the paper.
And although she was forced out, wouldn't you think that that does become an untenable situation for you as the columnist, that
yes,
you would not want to work for them? And yet, now that voice is lost.
Yeah. So it shows that I think a publisher who has this point of view, who isn't willing to be open to other points of view, should get out of the business. What's complex these days is that so much of the media world is simply following one particular point of view, that I think people have come to believe that nothing can be trusted that they read. Because Fox News initially began this fight by distorting the news entirely, which it does. Even its news content is purely reflective of a far-right point of view. Because of that, in a lot of venues, they can't trust that what they're reading is fairly presented. And since we have a government now that you can't trust, when you see Pam Bondi's Justice Department or RFK Jr.'s Health Department or Kash Patel's FBI, what they're saying, you can't trust that. So where does a person turn if they want to find information that is fairly presented, points of view that are an accurate representation of what people really believe and not just a reflection of what they're told to believe?
I used to go to, New York Times, Washington Post, and the LA Times were my go-to sources, and now I've essentially lost two. Even though I know we're talking about, well, the news side is still has its integrity and is robust, how do I know that Jeff Bezos is not going to dip his fingers into that as well going forward? It's early in the Trump administration, and these billionaires have shown no inclination to not kowtow to whatever the administration wants.
So let me bring up another issue that is problematic for reporters on the news reporting side of things, and that is getting straight what is actually going on in Washington. And what I mean about that is that usually you can tell what an administration is doing, the Biden administration, the Obama administration, and so on, because there is something of a unity of voice. People follow what the boss says, perhaps. One of the good reasons to have press conferences is that when the president answers a question, that makes it clear to the bureaucracy what the point of view of the administration is. These days, it seems as though so much decision-making is sort of on the fly, made by Donald Trump. It goes back and forth, greatest example being the tariffs that are on in the morning and off in the afternoon and back on again, that if you're a reporter, you can't really write with any assurance about what it is that's coming out. And I would think that on the one hand, that gives you good opportunity for coverage because you can write about the disparate views, which is often newsworthy. On the other hand, it doesn't help people who read your content, hear it on the radio, watch it on television, and it certainly doesn't help guide the markets. I would think it'd be very tough to be a reporter covering the White House these days.
And really, the only option they have is to track down the actual action. Go to the entity that actually imposes the tariffs and find out if it's actually happening. But that's a lot more work, and it's late to the game.
Yeah.
Because if you're capturing it while it's happening, you're not being able to advance the story that this is going to happen. And what, at the end of the day, it leaves the citizens at a loss. What is exactly happening? It's not for lack of trying. I think over time, we have to figure out who we can trust as a source and who we can't. Oftentimes, I'm finding that the anonymous sources being quoted in articles tend to be the more reliable ones, mm-hmm. rather than the cabinet members or the president, who's like a ping pong ball.
You alluded to, Rex, how difficult it is to cover the White House these days. Bearing in mind that there's always been a love-hate relationship between the press corps and the press secretary to the president. So it's not brand new if there's any animus. But I'm wondering whether what you guys have observed yourself or what you may or may not feel about the current press secretary, not that she's a woman, but that she's a 27-year-old woman, and she's been dressing down some members of the press. And I have to think that there are some of those people sitting in that room saying, who the hell is this woman? You couldn't carry my typewriter, as we used to say in the old days. And now she's up there every day denouncing one media outlet or another.
Yeah, she's great at the worst parts of her job, or what Trump and she would consider to be the most important parts of her job, is to control the narrative and shoot down everybody else who is going to challenge it.
It's difficult, I think, because of the administration taking over who gets to get into the press pool to cover the president when the room is small and only a few reporters can travel, with the White House now controlling who gets into the room, as opposed to the White House Correspondents Association, and rewarding these journalists who always distort the facts, rewarding right-wing entities that really don't provide trustworthy coverage. What that does is it makes you suspicious of even the pool reports. You just don't know if you're getting accurate coverage now from reporters who feed their information to other reporters. You understand that's how this works. A reporter who is part of the pool takes notes on everything, then provides a feed to everybody else who can then use that material. Here's what actually happened in the Oval Office when there were only a few reporters. But if you have a right-wing outfit that isn't committed to truth-telling being the one taking those notes, it affects everything that comes out. As I say, you know, garbage in, garbage out. So it's a difficult task these days.
Well, that comes back to what Judy was saying about anonymous sources. So you might want to trust anonymous sources in a story whose byline you trust, and whose news outlet you trust. So that's an important consideration of where's the anonymous source being relayed, and that the onus is on reporters. You're talking, Rex, about how hard it is for reporters to develop sources outside of those So who knows, some of them might be cabinet members, but the staffs in the White House, they need to have good reporting sources to be able to tell the real stories.
You know, one of the interesting threats to those sources, though, is that they might be found out. The Department of Homeland Security, we've learned, they've had to take lie detector tests in a hunt for who is making leaks to the press. Imagine the great workplace environment if your boss is calling you in to take a lie detector as to whether you've spoken to a reporter. We've all had to deal with workplace issues as leaders of organizations, and I can't imagine that things are good in the federal workforce these days, but anybody who talks to a reporter about things is at risk, which makes it, again, much harder for journalists to actually do their job if you're potentially imperiling the livelihood of somebody who you're talking to.
Yeah, but one of the dirty little secrets of journalism is the fact that the leakers are often the people at the tippy top of the chain, the ones not likely to get the lie detector test. I mean, that's often the case. I mean, Donald Trump was notorious for being a leaker himself.
Yeah.
Although, again, we don't know whether he's going to change his mind before the story comes out or is published. So that makes it more difficult. Again, it's this whole idea that truth has become elusive for us.
Yeah,
we do not know where it is or what it will become. And even if we do see that the tariff is taking effect, they could pull it off. You know, they could rescind it within minutes. So it's such a time of upheaval, and I would almost say chaos.
Oh, no. I'm starting a campaign. I believe the word chaos is being overused. I alluded to it on another program. And chaos, as far as I'm concerned, is when the prehistoric animal is chasing the crowd down the street as the crowd screams in horror.
I think that sounds perfectly apt.
We're screaming in horror.
So that's the word chaos.
We'll see. If you have views, folks, media at WAMC.org is where we like to get email, and we'd love to hear your point of view. We'll share them with listeners next time. This is the Media Project of Northeast Public Radio. That fellow who doesn't like chaos, at least the term thereof, Ira Fussfeld. Barbara Lombardo is here, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith, some veteran journalists, just sharing our views on some of the issues that are important. I want to talk just a minute about libel protections, because this is one of the issues that is confronting us, actually. There are many challenges to trying to cover the Trump administration. Many efforts are being thrown up to try to stop accurate coverage. But one of the pernicious threats out there is the loss of the libel protection afforded by a great Supreme Court decision 61 now years ago, New York Times v. Sullivan, which gave basically empowered investigative and watchdog reporting by protecting the press from frivolous lawsuits. So that in order for a public official to succeed in a libel suit, first, they have to prove that what was published was false. Second, they have to prove that it was published with knowledge of the falsity or with reckless disregard for whether it was true or false. So with that protection, journalists have been able to cover public officials without fear of losing their livelihood or finding themselves in court. But now that's imperiled. Why is that? What's the threat there? Well, we have some Supreme Court justices who say they want to overturn that libel standard. And I think the threat is that there's a lot of money behind the people who are challenging it, right?
You know, there's no doubt that journalism as an industry or as a profession flourished after the Sullivan case in the early 60s. I mean, you saw a growth in investigative reporting unlike any other time in history. The idea that this could face some pullback is incredibly concerning at all levels of journalism, from, you know, the local, small local paper to the big paper like New York Times, which has, you know, a stable of lawyers to help protect it. The Supreme Court justices have not been reticent to say that they think that the protections governing us have gone too far. I mean, initially started with just government officials, but it's been expanded over time to include celebrities, people in the public eye. But we have faced challenges over the years. You know, you had the Food Lion case where ABC was challenged because of some of the ways in which they pursued their story, but eventually, you know, they were upheld. So I think it's something we all need to be mindful of, especially for the smaller papers or the regional mid-sized papers that don't have the financial wherewithal to mount a legal challenge. I think in the public's eye, our trust is eroded in the news media, and the idea of facing a jury in some of these cases is formidable.
And one of the problems is that even if the law would be upheld in the newspaper's favor, they can really force you out of business by bringing lawsuits that really are frivolous and that they know that they don't have a chance of winning or they shouldn't win, and they can just cost you so much money and time.
Just in the defense of it, and that therefore will raise the cost of your libel insurance, which usually is about a $50,000 deductible anyway. So that's a lot of money, a lot of peril as a result of the libel threat.
But I think that people just need to focus, to the extent that people can focus on anything these days, that the fate and the potential loss of the New York Times v. Sullivan case by another Supreme Court is not just a newspaper issue or a media issue. It impacts the media, to be sure, but it impacts the people who are reading and watching and listening to news coverage if the media organization doing the coverage is reluctant in any way because it fears that they're going to break the law or otherwise hurt its reputation. This is a very important bedrock piece of legislation that would harm not just the industry if it were to be overturned.
And that is where we have to leave it, with rather gloomy point of view.
I specialize in that.
Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank David Castina, our producer, and thank you for joining us again this week. Hope we'll see you next week on The Media Project.
Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
To represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.